to be an old science fiction term, I think. Kind of a net joke. It just means to travel directly, instead of going the long way round. R.L. style. R.L. means real life, remember? Habu seemed very quiet and withdrawn. Rini wondered if she'd shown him enough for a first visit. It was hard to know what an adult mind would make of all this. Everyone she knew had started net riding in childhood. "Do you want to go on with our simulated shopping trip?" Habu turned. "Of course. Please. This is all so astonishing." She smiled to herself. "Good. Well, as I said, if we wanted a particular store, we could have beamed directly to it. But let's browse." Rini had been a professional for so long that the thrill of what was possible had worn off. Like her little brother, she had discovered the net at much the same time as she discovered the real world, and learned her way around both long before adolescence. Stephen was still interested in net for net's sake, but Rini was well past the sense of wonder stage. She didn't even like shopping, and whenever possible just reordered from an existing account. Habu, however, was a child in these virtual realms, but a man-child, she reminded herself, with a sophisticated and adult sensibility, however primitive her city-dweller prejudices made his background seem. So it was both refreshing and a little horrifying to accompany him on this maiden voyage. No, more than just a little horrifying. Seeing it through his eyes, Lambda Mall seemed so huge and loud, so vulgar. Habu stopped in front of one store's outside displays and gestured to see the full advertisement. Weenie didn't bother. Although his sim was standing motionless before the shop's coruscating facade, she knew that he was currently in the middle of a family melodrama in which the crusty but benign father was slowly being brought around to the joys of purchasing a Critipong home entertainment unit with multiple access features. She watched the bushman's small sim speaking and reacting to invisible presences, and again felt a slightly shamed responsibility. After a few minutes, Habu shook himself all over like a wet dog and stepped away. "Did tight-fisted but basically kindly Dad see the error of his ways?" she asked. "Who were those people?" "Not people. On the net, real people are called citizens. Those were puppets. Constructs which look like people. Invented things, just like the stores here. And even the mall itself."
"Not real? But they talked to me. Answered questions."
"Just a slightly more expensive form of advertising, and they aren't as smart as they act. Go back and ask Mom about the Soweto Uprising, or the Second Ngosani Administration. She'll just tell you all over again about the joys of retinal display."
Habu thought this over. "They are like ghosts, then. Things with no souls."
Rini shook her head. "No souls, that's true. But ghost means something else on the net. I'll tell you about it one day."
They continued along the street, floating forward at walking speed, a comfortable pace for browsing. "How can you tell the difference?" Habu asked. "Between citizens and puppets?"
"You can't always. If you want to know, you ask. By law, we all have to respond. Constructs, too. And we all have to tell the truth, although I'm sure that law gets broken often enough."
"I find that thought upsetting."
"It takes some getting used to. Well, we're pretending to shop, so let's go on in. Unless something in the advertising offended you."
"No, it was interesting. I think Dad should get more exercise. He has an unhealthy face."
Rini laughed as they stepped through into the store. Habu gaped.
"But it is just a tiny space seen from outside. Is this more visual magic?"
"You must remember, none of this is real in the normal sense. Frontage space on the mall is expensive, so the exterior displays tend to be small. But the commercial note itself isn't behind it as it would be in a real market. We've just moved into another location on the information network, which could be right next to the Polytechnic's janitorial services, or a children's adventure game, or the banking records for an insurance company."
They looked across the large and expensive-looking shop. Quiet music was playing, which Rini promptly blocked. Some of the subliminals were getting very sophisticated, and she didn't want to discover when she went offline that she'd bought herself some expensive gadget. The walls and floor space of the simulated store were covered with tasteful abstract sculptures. The products themselves, displayed atop low pillars, seemed to glow with their own soft inner light, like holy relics.
"Do you notice there are no windows?"
Habu turned to look behind him. "But there were several on either side of the door where we came in."
"Only on the outside. Those were showing us the equivalent of a page in a printed catalog. Easy to do. Far more difficult and expensive, not to mention distracting to potential customers, would be to show what was going on in Lambda Mall outside the facade. So, on the inside, no windows.
And no people, either. Is this store, then, an unpopular place?
It is all a matter of choice. I didn't change the default setting when I came in. If you remember your computer terminology from last week, default
is the setting you get unless you specify otherwise.
Exactly. And the default in this kind of store is usually alone with the merchandise. If we want, we can see any other customers who themselves choose to be seen.
She made a gesture. For a brief moment, a half dozen Sims flashed into sight, bending over one or another of the pillars.
And if we want, we could be visited by a shop assistant immediately. Or, if we hover around long enough, one will eventually appear anyway, just to help us toward a decision.
Habu moved across the floor to the nearest gently gleaming device. And these are representations of what this company sells?
Some of what they sell. We can change the display, too, or see only the things we're interested in hovering in front of us. We can even eliminate the showroom and view them only as text, with descriptions and prices. I'm afraid that's what I tend to do.
Habu chuckled. The man who lives beside the waterhole does not dream of thirst.
Another of your people's sayings?
One of my father's.
He reached his blunt-fingered hand toward one of the pads, a thin rectangle small enough to fit in a simulated palm.
Can I pick this up?
Yes, but it will only feel as realistic as your own equipment allows it to feel. I'm afraid the Sims we're wearing are pretty basic.
Habu turned it in his hands. I can feel the weight of it. Quite impressive. And look at this reflection across its screen. But I suppose this is no more real than that water you created my first day in simulation.
Well, somebody spent more time working on that than I did on my puddle.
Good afternoon, citizens.
An attractive black woman a few years younger than Rini appeared beside them. Habu started guiltily, and she smiled.
Are you interested in personal access devices?
We are merely looking today, thank you.
Rini examined the perfect, just-ironed crease of the woman's pants and her flawless white teeth.
My friend,
are you a citizen or a puppet? Habu asked.
The woman turned toward him.
I am a Type E construct,
she said, her voice still as warm and soothing as when she had greeted them.
Respondent to all UN codes for retail display. If you wish to deal with a citizen, I will be happy to summon one now. If you have a complaint about my performance, please indicate, and you will be connected with...
No,
Rini said. There's no need. My friend is on his first trip to Lambda Mall and was just curious.
The smile was still in place, although Rini fancied it was a bit stiffer than before. But that was silly. Why should a puppet be programmed with hurt feelings?
I am glad I could answer your question. Is there anything else I can tell you about this or any of Critipong Electronics' other fine products?
Out of an obscure sense of guilt, she asked the saleswoman, the puppet saleswoman, she reminded herself, a mere piece of code, to demonstrate the pad for them.
The freehand is the latest in portable access data units,
the puppet began, with the most sophisticated voice recognition of any pad in its price range. It also allows the pre-programming of hundreds of different daily tasks, a smart phone filtering service, and a wealth of other extras that have made Critipong Asia's leader in consumer data manipulation products. As the puppet described the voice recognition features for Habu, Rini wondered whether it was a coincidence that this particular salesperson appeared as a black woman, or whether it had been summoned up tailor-made to match her own net index and address. A few minutes later, they were outside again, standing in the simulated street.
Just for your information, she said, it isn't really polite to ask if people are citizens or not, but unless you specifically request a live human being, most of the salespeople in stores will be puppets.
But I thought you said that it was the law.
It is the law, but it's a social thing, a little delicate. If you're talking to a citizen and you ask them that question, then you're implying that they're, well, boring enough or mechanical enough to be artificial.
Ah, so one should only ask if one is reasonably certain that the person in question is a puppet.
Or unless you really, really need to know.
And what might cause such a need? Rini grinned.
Well, if you were falling in love with someone you met here, for instance. Come on, let's find a place to sit down.
Habu sighed and straightened up. His gray sim had been sagging in its chair.
There is still so much I do not understand. We are still on the mall, are we not?
We are. This is one of its main public squares.
So what can we hope to do at this place? We cannot eat. We cannot drink.
Rest, to begin with. VR can be like long-distance driving. You don't do much, but you still get tired.
As blood was red and wet in whichever artery it flowed, so too the crowd in the teeming streets seemed identical in its sheer variety to any other in Lambda Mall. The fraction of the mall's visitors that floated, walked, or crawled past Café Boule seemed no different than what Rini and Khabu had seen upon first entering the commercial sector, or in the streets of the electronics district. The most basic Sims, which usually represented the most infrequent visitors, stopped frequently to rubberneck. Other, more detailed Sims were covered in bright colors and traveling in groups, dressed up as though for a party. And some wore sophisticated rigs, which would have been righted home in the poshest sectors of the inner district. Sims like handsome young gods, which turned virtual heads everywhere they passed.
But why is it a café? Why not a resting house or some such?
Rini turned back to Khabu. The slope of his shoulders indicated fatigue. She would have to take him offline soon. It was easy to forget what a staggering sensory experience a first visit to the net could be.
Because café sounds nicer. No, I'm teasing. For one thing, if we had the equipment for it, we could eat and drink here, or at least feel like we were doing so. If we had the implants some rich people have, we could taste things we've never tasted in the real world. But even a real café serves more than just food and drink.
She made a gesture, and they were surrounded by the gentle sounds of a Poulenc string quartet. The noise of the street dropped to a low murmur in the background.
We are essentially renting a place where we can be, somewhere we can stop and think and talk and admire the parade without obstructing a public thoroughfare. And unlike a real restaurant, once you've paid for your table, your waiter is always available, but only when you want him.
Khabu settled back. It would be nice to have a beer.
When we go offline, I promise, to celebrate your first day on the net.
Her companion watched the streetlight for a while, then turned to survey the Café Boule itself. The striped awnings fluttered, though there was no wind. Waiters and waitresses in clean white aprons strode among the tables, balancing trays stacked improbably high with glasses, although very few of the customers seemed to have any glassware in front of them.
This is a nice place, Ms. Sulawayo.
Rini, please.
Very well. This is a nice place, Rini. But why are so many tables empty? If it is as inexpensive as you said,
not everyone here chooses to be seen, although they cannot simply be invisible without some indication.
She pointed to a perfect but deserted simulation of a black cast-iron table with a vase of exquisite daisies in the center of the white tablecloth.
Do you see the flowers? How many other empty tables have them?
Most of them.
That means someone is sitting there, or occupying the virtual space, more accurately. They just choose not to be seen. Perhaps they are secret lovers, or their Sims are famous and readily recognizable. Or perhaps they merely forgot to change the default setting from the last people who sat there.
Khabu contemplated the empty table. Are we visible? He asked at last.
Oh, yes. I have nothing to hide. I did put a mute on our conversation, though. Otherwise we'd be surrounded by hawkers as soon as we leave, waiting to sell you maps, instruction manuals, so-called enhancement packages, you name it. They love first-timers.
And that is all most people do here? Sit?
There are various kinds of virtual performances going on, for those who are not interested in watching the crowd. Dancing, object creation, comedy. I just haven't requested access to any of them. Do you want to see one?
No, thank you, Rini. The quiet is very nice.
The quiet lasted only a few more moments. A loud detonation made Rini shout in surprise. On the street outside the café, the crowd swirled and scattered like a herd of antelope fleeing a lion's charge.
Six Sims, all muscular males dressed in martial leather and steel, stood in the open space, shouting at one another and waving large guns. Rini turned up the volume so she and Khabu could hear.
"We told you to stay off Engelbart Street!"
one of them bellowed in the flat tones of American English, lowering his machine gun so that it jutted from his waist like a black metal phallus.
"The day when we listen to barkies is the day pigs fly!"
another shouted back.
"Go on back to your hell box, little boy!"
An expanding star of fire leaped from the muzzle of the first man's gun. The fut-fut-fut sound was loud even through the damped audio in Weenie's earplugs. The one who had been told to stay off Engelbart Street was instead abruptly spread all over the thoroughfare in question. Bright blood and intestines and bits of meat flung everywhere. The crowd gave a collective shout of fear and tried to push back even farther. More guns flashed, and two more of the muscular men were smashed down onto the street, oozing red from scorched black holes. The survivors lifted their weapons, stared at each other for a moment, then disappeared. Idiots! Weenie turned to Habu, but he had vanished too. A moment's worry was eased when she saw the edge of his gray sim poking out from behind the chair.
Come back, Habu. It was just some young fools larking around. He shot that man!
Habu crept back into his seat, looking warily at the crowd which had rolled back over the spot like an incoming tide.
Simulation, remember? Nobody really shot anybody. But they're not allowed to do that in public areas. Probably a bunch of school kids.
For a worried moment she thought of Stephen, but such tricks were not his style. She also doubted he and his friends could get access to such high-quality sims. Rich punks. That was what these had been.
And they may lose their access privileges if they get caught.
It was all false, then?
All false. Just a bunch of neckboys on the prank.
This is a strange world indeed, Rini. I think I am ready to go back now. She had been right. She had let him stay too long.
Not back, she said gently. Offline. Things like that will help you remember this isn't a real place.
Offline, then.
Right.
She moved her hand, and it was so. The beer was cold. Habu was tired but happy, and Rini was just beginning to unwind when she noticed that her pad was blinking. She considered ignoring it. The battery was low, and when the power faded, strange things often happened. But the only priority messages were those from home, and Stephen would have returned from school a few hours ago. The beer hall's node was not working, and her battery wasn't capable of boosting her signal enough to use it from the table. So she apologized to Habu and went out to the street in search of a public note, squinting against the late afternoon glare. The neighborhood was not a good one. Loose bits of plastic crinkle blowing like autumn leaves. Empty bottles and ampoules in discarded paper bags lying in the gutter. She had to walk 4 long blocks before she found a note, defaced with graffiti, but in service. It was strange being so close to the well-manicured grounds of the Poly, and yet in another world. An entropic world in which everything seemed to be turning to dust and litter and flakes of dried paint. Even the little lawn around the public node was only a phantom, a patch of baked earth and skeletal brown grass. She jiggled the pad's access jack in the node until she made something resembling clean contact. The booth was voice only, and she listened to her home phone pulse a dozen times before someone answered. "What do you want?" her father slurred.
"Papa, my pad was showing a message. Did Stephen call me?"
That boy? No, little girl, I call you. I call you to say I won't put up with no nonsense no more. A man got a right to some rest. Your brother, he and his friends make a mess, make too much noise. I tell him to clean up the kitchen. He say it's not his job.
It's not his job. I told him if he cleaned his room...
None of your lip, girl. You all think you can talk back to your father like I'm nobody. Well, I throw that upstart boy out. Right out for good. And if you don't get home and clean this place up, I throw you out, too.
You what? What do you mean, threw him out?
There was a sly, pleased sound to Long Joseph's voice now.
You hear me? I throw his skinny behind out of my house. He want to play silly buggers with his friends and make noise? He can live with his friends. I deserve some peace.
You...
Weenie swallowed hard. When her father got into these moods, he was just itching for conflict. Smashed and self-righteous, he would carry it on for days if she fought back.
That wasn't fair. Stephen has a right to have friends.
If you don't like it, you can go too.
Rini hung up the phone and stared for long moments at a stripe of cadmium yellow paint splashed across the face of the note. The long tail of a graffiti letter so arcane that she couldn't make it out, her eyes filled with tears. There were times she understood the violent impulses that made the netboys blow each other to shreds with make-believe guns. Sometimes she even understood people who used real guns. The jack stuck in the public node when she pulled it out. She stared at the snapped wire for a moment, swore,
then threw it down on the ground where it lay like a tiny, stunned snake. "He's only 11. You can't throw him out for making noise. Anyway, he has to live here by law."
"Oh, you going to call the law on me, girl?"
Long Joseph's undershirt was stained at the armpits. The nails on his bare feet were yellow and too long. At that moment, Rainey hated him.
"You can't do that."
"You go, too. Go on. I don't need no smart-mouthed girl in my house. I told your mama before she died, that girl getting above herself, putting on airs."
Rainey stepped around the table toward him. Her head felt like it might explode.
"Go ahead. Throw me out, you old fool. Who will you get to clean for you, cook for you? How far do you think your government check will go without me bringing home my salary?"
Joseph Sulawayo waved his long hands in disgust.
"Talk that shit to me. Who brought you into this world? Who put you through that Afrikaner school so you could learn that computer nonsense?"
"I put myself through that school."
What had started as a simple headache had now transmuted into spikes of icy pain.
"I worked in that cafeteria cleaning up after other students for 4 years, and now I have a good job. Then I come home and clean up after you."
She picked up a dirty glass, dried residue of milk untouched since the night before, and lifted it to smash it on the floor, to break it into the thousand sharp fragments she already felt rattling in her own head. After a moment, she put it down on the table and turned away, breathing hard.
"Where is he?"
"Where is who?"
"God damn it! You know who! Where did Stephen go?"
"How should I know?"
Long Joseph was rooting around in the cupboard, looking for the bottle of cheap wine he had finished 2 nights before.
"He go off with his damn friend, that Eddie. What do you do with my wine, girl?"
Rainey turned and went into her room, slamming the door shut behind her. It was impossible to talk with him. Why did she even try? The picture on her desk showed him over 20 years younger, tall and dark and handsome. Her mother stood beside him in a strapless dress, shielding her eyes from the Margaret summer sun. And Rainey herself, age 3 or 4, was nestled in the crook of her father's arm, wearing a ridiculous bonnet that made her head look as big as her entire body. One small hand had wrapped itself in her father's tropical shirt, as if seeking an anchor against the strong currents of life. Rainey scowled and blinked back tears. It did no good to look at that picture. Both of those people were dead, or as good as dead. It was a dreadful thought, but no less true for its horror. She found a last spare battery in the back of her drawer, slotted it into the pad, and phoned Eddie's house. Eddie answered. Rainey was not surprised. Eddie's mother, Mutzi, spent more time out drinking with her friends than home with her children. That was one of the reasons Eddie got into trouble, and though he was a pretty good kid, it was one of the reasons Rainey was not comfortable with Stephen staying there.
"God, look at yourself, girl,"
she thought as she waited for Eddie to fetch her brother.
"You're turning into an old woman, disapproving of everyone."
"Rainey?"
"Yes, Stephen, it's me. Are you okay? He didn't hit you or anything, did he?"
"No. The old drunk couldn't catch me." Despite her own anger, she felt a moment of fright at hearing him talk about their father that way.
"Listen, is it all right for you to stay there tonight? Just till Papa calms down? Let me talk to Eddie's mother."
"She's not here, but she said it was okay."
Rainey frowned. "Ask her to call me anyway. I want to talk to her about something.
Stephen, don't hang up."
"I'm here."
He was sullen.
"What about Silky? You never told me if you came back to school after you three got in that trouble."
End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over. Side 3. City of Golden Shadow. Otherland, Volume 1. By Tad Williams. Continuing on page 66.
Stephen hesitated.
"He was sick."
"I know. But did he come back to school?"
"No. His mama and dad moved into Durban. I think they're living with Soki's aunt or something."
She tapped her fingers on the pad, then realized she had almost cut the connection. "Stephen, put the picture on, please."
"It's broken. Eddie's little sister knocked over the station."
Rainey wondered if that was really true, or if Stephen and his friend were into some mischief they didn't want her to see. She sighed. It was 40 minutes to Eddie's flat block by bus, and she was exhausted. There was nothing she could do. "You phone me at work tomorrow when you get home from school. When's Eddie's mama coming back?"
"Soon."
"And what are the two of you going to do tonight until she gets back?"
"Nothing."
There was definitely a defensive note in his voice.
"Just do some net. Football match, maybe."
"Stephen," she began,
then stopped. She didn't like the interrogatory tone of her own voice. How could he learn to stand on his own 2 feet if she treated him like he was a baby? His own father had wrongfully accused him of something just hours earlier, then thrown him out of his home.
Stephen, I trust you. You call me tomorrow, here?
Okay.
The phone clicked, and he was gone. Weenie plumped up her pillow and sat back on her bed, trying to find a comfortable position for her aching head and neck. She had planned to read an article in a specialist magazine tonight, the kind of thing she wanted to have under her belt when career review time came around. But she was too drained to do anything much. Wave some frozen food and then watch the news. Try not to lie awake for hours worrying. Another evening shot to hell.
You seem upset, Miss Sulawayo. Is there anything I can do to help you?
She took an angry breath.
My name's Rini. I wish you'd start calling me that, Habu. You make me feel like a grandmother.
I am sorry. I meant no offense. His slender face was unusually solemn. He lifted his tie and scrutinized the pattern. Rini wiped the screen, blotting out the schematic she had been laboring over for the last half hour. She took out a cigarette and pulled the tab.
No, I'm sorry. I had no right to take my... I apologize.
She leaned forward, staring at the sky blue of the empty screen as the smoke drifted in front of it.
You've never told me anything about your family. Well, not much. She felt him looking at her.
When she met it, his gaze was uncomfortably sharp, as though he had extrapolated from her question about his family to her own troubles. It never paid to underestimate Habu. He had already moved past the basics of computing and was beginning to explore areas that gave her other adult students fits. He would be constructing programmer-level code soon. All this in a matter of a few months. If he was studying at night to make such a pace, he must be going without sleep altogether.
My family? He asked. That means a different thing where I come from. My family is very large, but I assume you mean my mother and father.
And sisters? And brothers?
I have no brothers, although I have several male cousins. I have 2 younger sisters, both of whom are still living with my people. My mother is living there, too, although she has not been well.
His expression, or the lack of it, suggested that his mother's illness was nothing small.
My father died many years ago.
I'm sorry. What did he die of, if you don't mind talking about it?
His heart stopped.
He said it simply, but Rini wondered at the stiffness of his tone. Habu was often formal, but seldom anything but open in his conversation. She put it down to pain he did not wish to share. She understood that.
What was it like for you growing up? It must have been very different from what I knew.
His smile came back, but only a small one.
I am not so certain of that, Rini. In the Delta we lived mostly outdoors, and that is very different, of course, from living beneath a city roof. Some nights since I came here, I still have trouble sleeping, you know. I go outside and sleep in the garden just so I can feel the wind, see the stars. My landlady thinks I am very strange.
He laughed, his eyes almost closed.
But other than that, it seems to me that all childhoods must be much alike. I played. I asked questions about the things around me. Sometimes I did what I should not and was punished. I saw my parents go to work each day, and when I was old enough, I was put to school.
School? In the Okavango swamps?
Not the sort you know, Rini. Not with an electronic wall and VR headsets. Indoor school was much later for me. I was taken by my mother and her relatives and taught the things I should know. I never said that our childhoods were identical, only much alike. When I was first punished for doing something I should not have, it was for straying too near the river. My mother was afraid that crocodiles might take me. I imagine that your first punishments were incurred for something different.
You're right, but we didn't have any electronic walls in my school. When I was a little girl, all we had were a couple of obsolete microcomputers. If they were still around, they'd be in a museum now.
My world has changed also since I was a young child. That is one of the things that brought me here.
What do you mean?
Habu shook his head with slow regret, as though she were the student rather than he, and she had fastened on to some ultimately unworkable theory. When he spoke, it was to change the subject.
Did you ask me about my family out of curiosity, Rini? Or is there some problem with yours that is making you sad? You do seem sad.
For a moment she was tempted to deny it or to push it aside. It didn't feel proper for a teacher to complain to a student about her home life, even though they were more or less the same age. But she had come to think of Habu as a friend, an odd companion because of his background, but a friend nevertheless. The pressures of raising a little brother and looking after her troubled and troublesome father had meant that her friends from university days had drifted away, and she had not made many new ones.
I do worry.
She swallowed, disliking her own weakness, the messiness of her problems. But it was too late to stop.
My father threw my little brother out of the house, and he's only 11 years old. But my father's got it into his bloody mind to take a stand, and he won't let him back until he apologizes. Stephen is stubborn, too. I hope that's the only way he's like Papa.
She was a little surprised at her own vehemence.
So he won't give in. He's been staying with a friend for 3 weeks now. 3 weeks! I hardly get to see him or talk to him.
Habu nodded. I understand your worry. Sometimes when one of my folk has a dispute with his family, he goes to stay with other relatives. But we live very close together, and all see each other often.
That's just it. Stephen's still going to school. I've been checking with the office. And Eddie's mother, this friend's mother, says he's okay. I don't know how much I trust her, though. That's part of the problem.
She stood up, trailing smoke, and walked to the far wall, just needing to move.
Now I'm going on and on about it again. But I don't like it. Two stupid men, one big, one little, and neither one of them is going to say he's wrong.
But you said your younger brother was not wrong, Habu pointed out. If he were to apologize, it is true that he would be showing respect for his father. But if he accepts blame that is not his, then he would also be submitting to injustice to maintain the peace. I think you are worried that would not be a good lesson.
Exactly. His people, our people, had to fight against that for decades.
Rini shrugged angrily and stubbed the cigarette out.
But it's more than politics. I don't want him to think that might makes right, that if you are pushed down yourself, it's acceptable then to turn around and find someone weaker you can push down. I don't want him to end up like his...
Habu held her gaze. He seemed capable of finishing the sentence for her, but didn't. After a long pause, Rini cleared her throat.
This is a waste of your tutorial time. I apologize. Shall we try that flowchart again? I know it's boring, but it's the kind of thing you're going to have to know for exams, however well you're doing with everything else.
Habu raised an inquiring eyebrow, but she ignored it. Habu was standing at the edge of a sharp spur of rock. The mountainside stretched away beneath him, a curving, glass-smooth freefall of shiny black. In his outstretched palm lay an old-fashioned pocket watch. As Rini stared, Habu began to take it apart.
"Move away from the edge," she called.
Couldn't he see the danger?
"Don't stand so close."
Habu looked up at her. His eyes crinkled into slits and smiled. "I must find out how it works. There is a ghost inside it." Before she could warn him again, he jerked, then held up his hand wonderingly like a child. A drop of blood, round as a gem, became liquid and flowed down his palm.
"It bit me," he said.
He took a step backward, then toppled over the precipice. Rini found herself staring down from the edge. Habu had vanished. She searched the depths, but could see nothing but mists and long-winged white birds, who circled slowly and made mournful sounds.
"Tehui, tehui, tehui."
She surfaced from the dream, her heart still pounding. Her pad was beeping at her, quiet but insistent. She fumbled for it on the night table. The digital numbers read 2:27 a.m.
"Answer."
She flicked the screen upright. It took her a moment to recognize Stephen's friend Eddie. He was crying, his tears a silver track on his blue-lit face. Her heart went cold inside her chest.
"Rini, where's Stephen?"
He's sick, Rini. I don't know."
"What do you mean, sick? Where's your mama? Let me talk to her."
"She's not here."
"For God's sake. How is he sick, Eddie? Answer me."
"He won't wake up. I don't know, Rini. He's sick."
Her hands were shaking.
"Are you sure? He's not just sleeping very deeply?"
Eddie shook his head, confused and frightened.
"I got up. He's just lying there on the floor."
"Cover him with something. A blanket. I'll be right there. Tell your mother when she..." "Shit, never mind. I'll be right there."
She phoned for an ambulance, gave them Eddie's address, then called a cab. While she waited, fever-chilled with worry, she scrabbled in her desk drawers for coins to make sure she had enough cash. Long Joseph had burned out their credit with the cab company months ago. Except for a few dimly lit windows, there was no sign of life outside Eddie's flat block. No ambulance, no police. A sliver of anger pierced Rini's fear. 35 minutes already, and no response. That would teach them all to live in Pinetown. Things crunched under her feet as she hurried across the entranceway. A handwritten sign said the electronic lock on the main door was out of service. Someone had since removed the whole latching mechanism with a crowbar. The stairwell stank of all the usual things. But there was also a scorched smell, faint but sharp as of some long-ago fire. Rini took the stairs two at a time, running. She was gasping for breath when she reached the door. Eddie opened it. Two of his younger sisters sheltered behind him, eyes wide. The apartment was dark except for the jittery light of the wall screen's static. Eddie stood, mouth working, frightened and prepared for some kind of punishment. Rini didn't wait for him to think of something to say. Stephen lay on his side on the living room carpet, curled slightly, his arms drawn against his chest. She pulled the threadbare blanket away and shook him, gently at first, but then with increasing force as she called his name. She turned him onto his back, terrified by the slackness of his limbs. Her hands moved from his narrow chest to the artery beneath his jaw. He was breathing, but slowly, and his heartbeat also seemed strong but measured. She had been forced to take a first aid course as part of her teaching certificate, but could remember little beyond keeping the victim warm and administering mouth to mouth. Stephen didn't need that, at least not as far as she could tell. She lifted him and held him tight, trying to give him something, anything that might bring him back. He seemed small but heavy. It had been some time since he had let her clutch him this uninhibitedly. The strangeness of his weight in her arms made her suddenly feel cold all over. "What happened, Eddie?" Her heart felt as though it had been beating too fast for hours now. "Did you take some kind of drugs? Do some kind of charge?" Stephen's friend shook his head violently. "We didn't do anything. Nothing." She took a deep breath, trying to clear her head. The apartment looked a surreal shambles in the silver-blue light. Toys and clothes and unwashed dishes on every surface. There were no flat planes anywhere. "What did you eat? Did Stephen eat anything you didn't?" Eddie shook his head again. "We just waved some stuff." He pointed to the packaged dinner boxes, not surprisingly still out on the counter. Rini held her cheek close to Stephen's mouth just to feel his breath. As it touched her, warm and faintly sweet, her eyes filled with tears. "Tell me what happened. Everything. God damn it, where is that ambulance?" According to Eddie, they truly had done nothing much. His mother had gone out to her sister's, promising to be home by midnight. They had downloaded some movies, the kind Rini wouldn't let Stephen watch at home, but nothing so horrible she could imagine it having a physical effect on him, and made dinner. After sending Eddie's sisters to bed, they had sat up for a while talking before putting themselves to bed as well. "But I woke up. I don't know why. Stephen wasn't there. I just thought he went to the bathroom or something, but he didn't come back. And I kind of smelled something funny, so I was afraid maybe we'd left the wave on or something. So I went out." His voice hitched. He swallowed. "He was just lying there." There was a knock at the unlatched door, which swung open. Two jumpsuited paramedics entered like stormtroopers and brusquely took Stephen from her. She felt reluctant to let him go to these strangers, even though she herself had summoned them. She released some of her tension and fear by letting them know what she thought of their response time. They ignored her with professional elan as they quickly checked Stephen's vital signs. The clockwork performance of their routine ran down a bit as they discovered what Rini already knew. Stephen was alive but unconscious, and there was no sign of what had happened to him. "We will take him to the hospital," one of them said. Rini thought he made it sound like a favor.
"I'll go with you."
She didn't want to leave Eddie and his sisters alone. Only God knew when their useless mother might turn up, so she called another cab, then wrote a hasty note explaining where they were all going. Since the local cab company was unfamiliar with her father, she was able to use a card. As the paramedics loaded Stephen's gurney into the white van, she squeezed her brother's small, unmoving hand and leaned to kiss his cheek. It was still warm, which was reassuring, but his eyes were rolled up beneath his lids like those of a hanged man she had once seen in a history lesson. All she could see of them by the dim streetlights were two slivers of gray, screens showing an empty signal. Chapter 4. The Shining Place. Netfeed Arts. T.T. Jensen Retrospective begins. Visual. Two-door metal flake sticky. By Jensen. V.O. Based on car chase images from 20th century films, the staged sudden sculpture actions of fugitive San Francisco-based artist Tillamook Tayar Jensen require the presence of unwitting participants. including this legendary three-vehicle multiple fatality for which the reclusive Jensen is still being sought by authorities. Fargor sat and nursed his mead. A few of the inn's other patrons inspected him when they thought he wasn't looking, but quickly glanced away when he returned their stares. Dressed from throat to toes in black leather, with a necklace of razor-sharp merg teeth rattling on his chest, he didn't look like the sort of person they wanted to offend, even inadvertently. They were wiser than they knew. Not only was Thargor a mercenary swordsman renowned throughout the Middle Country for his quick temper and quicker blade, but he was in an even fouler mood than usual. It had taken him a long time to find the Wyvern's Tale, and the person he had come to the inn to meet should have arrived when the last watch was called, quite some time ago. He had been forced to sit and wait, both his temper and his rune-scribed broadsword Life Reaper too large for this low-ceilinged public house. On top of everything else, the mead was thin and sour. He was inspecting the serpent's nest of white scars on the back of his broad fist when someone made a just-standing-here noise behind him. The fingers of his other hand tightened around Life Reaper's leather-wrapped hilt as he turned his head and fixed the nervous innkeeper with sharp, ice-blue eyes. "Pardon me, sir," the man stuttered. He was large but fat. Thargor decided he would not need his rune sword, even if the man intended violence. Not that his bulging eyes and pale cheeks suggested he did, and lifted his eyebrow in inquiry. He did not believe in wasting words. "Is the mead to your liking?" the innkeeper asked. "It's local, made right here in Silnor Valley."
"It's horse piss, and I wouldn't want to meet the horse."
The man laughed, loudly and nervously.
"No, of course not, of course not."
The laugh ended up rather like a hysterical giggle as he eyed Life Reaper in her long black scabbard.
"The thing is, sir, the thing is, there's someone outside. Said he wants to speak to you."
"To me? He gave you my name, did he?"
"No, sir, no. Why, I don't even know your name. Don't have the slightest idea what your name is, and no interest in finding out."
He paused for breath.
"Although I'm sure it's a very respectable and euphonious name, sir."
Fargor grimaced.
"So how do you know he wants to speak to me? And what does he look like?"
"Simple enough, sir. He said, 'The big fellow, begging your pardon, sir, the one dressed in black.' Well, as you can see, sir, you're the biggest fellow here, and that's black you're dressed in, right enough. So you can understand—"
A raised hand stilled him.
"And?"
"And, sir? Ah, what he looks like. Well, that I couldn't rightly tell you, sir. It was shadowy, it was, and he was wearing a hooded cloak. Probably a very respectable gentleman, I'm sure, but what he looks like I couldn't tell you. Hooded cloak. Thank you, sir. Sorry to bother you."
Thargor frowned as the innkeeper hurried away, scuttling rather impressively for a man of his bulk. Who could be outside? The wizard Drera Jar? He was said to travel anonymously in this part of the Middle Country, and certainly had a bone or two to pick with Thargor. The affair of the Onyx ship alone would have made them eternal enemies, and that had merely been their latest encounter. Or could it be the haunted rider Caitlin, the banished elf prince? Although not a sworn enemy of Thargor's, the pale elf certainly would be looking to settle some scores after what had happened during their journey through Mithindor Valley. Who else might come looking for the swordsman in this unlikely place? Some local bravos he had offended? He had given those cutthroats a terrible thrashing back at the crossroads, but he doubted they would be ready for another go-round with him quite yet. Even from ambush, there was nothing to do but go and see. As he rose, leather trews creaking, the patrons of the Wyvern's Tale studiously examined their cups, although two of the braver tavern wenches watched him pass with more than a little admiration. He tugged at Life Reaper's pommel to make sure she sat loosely in her scabbard, then walked to the door. The moon hung full and fat over the stable yard, painting the low roofs with buttery light. Thargor let the door fall shut behind him and stood swaying a little, pretending to be drunk, but his hawk-like eyes were moving with the precision he had learned during a thousand nights like this, nights of moonlight and magic and blood. A figure detached itself from the shadow of a tree and stepped forward. Thargor's fingers tightened on his sword hilt as he listened for any faint sound that might betray the position of other attackers.
"Thargor?"
The hooded figure stopped a few paces away.
"Hell, man, are you drunk?"
The mercenary's eyes narrowed.
"Pithlet, what are you up to? You were supposed to meet me an hour ago, and inside at that. Something happened. I was delayed.
and when I arrived here, I could not go inside without drawing too much attention.
Pithlet swayed,
and not in feigned drunkenness. Thargor crossed the distance between them in two swift strides and caught the smaller man just before he collapsed. Hidden by the loose fabric, a dark stain had spread across the front of Pithlet's robe.
"Gods, what happened to you?"
Pithlet smiled weakly.
"Some bandits at the crossroads. Local bravos, I think. I killed two of them, but that was four too few."
Thargor cursed.
"I met them yesterday. There were a dozen to begin with. I am surprised that they are back to work so soon."
"A man has to earn his imperials one way or the other."
Pithlet winced.
"It was a last stroke, just as I broke away. I do not think it is mortal, but by the gods, it hurts."
"Come then. We will get that tended to. We have other business this full moon night, and I need you beside me. But afterward, we will do a magic trick, you and I."
Pithlet grimaced again as Thargor set him on his feet once more.
"A magic trick?"
"Yes. We will go back to that crossroads and turn four into none."
As it turned out, Pithlet's wound was long and bloody, but shallow. When it was bandaged and the little man had downed several cups of fortified wine to make up for the lost blood, he pronounced himself ready to ride. Since the hard physical work of the night's planned business was to be Thargor's, the mercenary took the thief at his word. While the moon was still rising in the sky, they left the Wyvern's Tail and its rustic patrons behind. The Silnor Valley was a long, narrow crevice that wound through the Catspine Mountains. As he and Pithlet coaxed their horses up the slender mountain track out of the valley, Thargor reflected that a cat would have to be malnourished indeed to have a spine so bony and sharp-knobbed. What little life and noise there had been down in the valley seemed a lifetime away here in the heights. The woods were oppressively thick and silent. Were it not for the bright moonlight, the swordsman thought, it would have been like sitting at the bottom of a well. He had been in more frightening places, but few as broodingly unpleasant as this part of the Catspine. The atmosphere seemed to be weighing on Pithlet, too.
"This is no place for a thief," he said. "We relish darkness, but only to hide us as we make our way toward glittering things, and it is nice to have somewhere to spend the ill-gotten gains afterward, and something to buy with them besides moss and stones."
Thargor grinned.
"If we succeed, you may buy yourself a small city to play in, with all the toys and bright lights you wish.
And if we do not succeed, I shall doubtless wish I were back facing the crossroads bandits again, wounded ribs and all."
"Doubtless."
They rode on for a while in near silence, companioned only by the clip-clopping of their horses' hooves. The track wound up and around, through twisted trees and standing stones of odd shape, upon whose surfaces the full moon picked out faint carvings, most of them incomprehensible, none pleasant to observe.
"They say that the old ones lived here once."
Pithlet's voice was determinedly casual.
"They do say that."
"Long ago, of course. Ages ago. Not any longer."
Thargor nodded, hiding a thin smile at Pithlet's nervous tone. Of all men, only Drera Jar and a few other sorcerers knew more of the old ones than Thargor, and no one was more feared by those atavistic deeps dwellers. If the ancient race still maintained some outpost here, let them show themselves. They bled like any other creature, albeit more slowly, and Thargor had sent swarms of their kind to hell already. Let them come. They were the least of his worries tonight.
"Do you hear something?"
asked Pithlet. Thargor reined up, quieting his Mount Blackwind with a strong hand. There was indeed a faint sound, a distant piping swirl that sounded a little like...
"Music," he grunted. "Perhaps you shall have the entertainment you were bemoaning earlier."
Pithlet's eyes were wide.
"I do not wish to meet those musicians."
"You may not have a choice."
Thargor stared at the sky, then back at the narrow track. The otherworldly music faded again.
"The trail to Massanek Coom crosses here and leads in that direction."
Pithlet swallowed.
"I knew I would have cause to regret accompanying you."
Thargor laughed quietly.
"If yon pipers are the worst we hear or see tonight, and we find the thing we seek, you will curse yourself for even hesitating."
"If, swordsman, if..."
Thargor turned Blackwind to the right and led Pithlet down the almost invisible trail into deeper shadow. Massanek Coom lay beneath the moon like a great dark beast. an ill-omened veil heavy with its own solitude. The very trees of the mountainside stopped at its edge, as though they would not touch it. The grass that grew upon its ground was short and sparse. The coombe was a scar in the woodland, an empty place. Almost empty, Thargor noted. At its center, partially obscured by rising mist, stood the great ring of stones. Inside the ring lay the barrow. Piflet tilted his head.
The music has stopped again. Why is that?
A man could go mad trying to make sense of such things.
Thargor dismounted and looped Blackwind's reins around a tree branch. The charger had already turned skittish, despite a life spent treading paths no other horses knew. No point dragging him down closer to the place's center.
A man could go equally mad trying to see the sense in this.
Piflet stared at the tall stones and shivered.
Defiling graves is a bad business, Thargor. Defiling the grave of an infamous sorceress seems to refute good sense entirely.
Thargor unsheathed Life Reaper. The runes glimmered silver-blue in the moon's cool light.
Khaleesa Thal would have liked you much when she lived, little thief. I am told she kept a stable of small and well-made fellows like yourself. Why should she change her ways simply because she is dead?
Do not joke. Betrothed to Khaleesa Thal was a byword for a bad bargain. A few days of maddening bliss followed by years of hideous agony.
The thief's eyes narrowed.
In any case, it is not me she will be meeting. If you have changed your mind, well and good. But I am not going inside in your place.
Thargor smirked.
I have not changed my mind. I but jested with you. I thought you rather pale. But perhaps it is the moonlight. Did you bring the scroll of Nanthior?
I did.
Piflet rooted in his saddlebag and produced the object. A thick furl of cured hide. Thargor thought he could guess what sort of hide it might be.
I nearly wound up in the tusky jaws of a werehog getting it,
Piflet added.
Remember, you promised that nothing would happen to it. I have a buyer waiting.
Nothing will happen to the scroll.
Thargor took it in his hand, faintly but invisibly disturbed by the way the script seemed to writhe against his skin.
Now, follow me. We will keep you well away from danger.
Well away from danger would mean out of these mountains altogether,
complained Piflet, but fell into step behind him. The mist surrounded them like a crowd of importuning beggars, pawing at their legs with cold tendrils. The great stone circle loomed before them, casting broad shadows on the moonlit fog.
Is any magical artifact worth such risk?
Piflet wondered quietly.
What can the mask of Khaleesa Thal be worth to you, who are no sorcerer?
Exactly what it is worth to the sorcerer who hired me to steal it.
Thargor replied,
50 diamonds of imperial weight.
50? By the gods!
Yes. Now shut your mouth.
Even as Thargor spoke, the strange music came to them again across the wind. A haunting, discordant skirl of pipes. Piflet's eyes bulged, but he held his tongue. The pair strode forward between the nearest pair of standing stones, ignoring the symbols carved there, and stopped at the base of the great barrow. The swordsman caught the thief's eyes once more, reinforcing the order of silence, then bent and put Life Reaper to work as though it were only a common farm tool. Soon Thargor had hacked away a wide stretch of turf. As he began to unpile the wall of stones that lay behind it, a whiff of decay and strange spices rose from the opening. Up on the hill, the horses nickered worriedly. When he had cleared a hole big enough to accommodate his wide shoulders, Thargor waved for his companion to hand him the scroll of Nanthior. As he unrolled it and whispered the words the sorcerer had taught him, words he had memorized but whose meaning he did not know, the painted symbols turned a gleaming red. At the same moment, a dim vermilion light was kindled in the depths of the barrow. When it died, and the glowing runes had also faded, Thargor furled the scroll and gave it back to Piflet. He took out his flints and lit the brand he had brought with him. There had been no need for a torch beneath the bright moon. Then eased himself down into the hole he had opened in Khaleesa Thal's tomb. His last sight of Piflet was of the nervous thief's silhouette limned by moonlight. The first sight of the barrow's interior was both daunting and reassuring. At the far end of the chamber in which he stood, another hole, this one in the shape of an oddly angled door,
led down into further darkness. The great mound was only the antechamber for a far larger excavation, but Thargor had expected nothing else. His sorcerer client's ancient book had described the place where Khaleesa Thal had immured herself before lying down to die as a labyrinth. He lifted a small sack from his belt and spilled its contents into his palm. Glow seeds, each one a small mote of light in this dark place, would serve to mark his path, so that he would not wander below the ground forever. Thargor was among the bravest of men, but when the day of his death came, he wished it to be beneath open sky. His father, who had lived a life of near slavery in the iron mines of Borikar, had died in a tunnel collapse. It was a fearful and unmanly way to go. As he pushed through the damp white roots that dangled from the ceiling, moving toward the door at the chamber's far end, he saw something strange and unexpected. A few paces to the right of the dark door, something was flickering like a low fire, although it cast no light on the earthen walls. As Thargor watched, it flared into full radiance, and became a hole in the air that seeped yellow light. He snarled and lifted Life Reaper, wondering if some magical spell had been laid here to trick him. But his blade did not shimmer in his fist, as she did in the presence of sorcery, and the barrow smelled of nothing but damp soil and the faint odor of mummification, neither unexpected in a burial mound. He paused, muscles tensed to iron hardness, and waited for some demon or wizard to step through this magical door. When nothing emerged, he moved to the shining place and tested the opening with his hand. It gave off no heat, only light. After looking around the antechamber once more just to be careful, Thargor had not survived so many near-fatal adventures through carelessness. He leaned forward until he could gaze into the bright portal. Thargor gasped in disbelief. Long moments passed. He did not move, nor did he show any sign of life when Piflet poked his head through the entrance hole and called to him, quietly at first, but then with increasing volume and urgency. The swordsman seemed to have turned to stone, a leather-clad stalagmite.
Thargor!
Piflet was shouting now, but his companion gave no sign of hearing.
The music is playing again! Thargor!
A moment later, the thief became even more alarmed.
There is something coming into the chamber! The tomb's guardian! Thargor!
The mercenary pulled himself back from the golden light, swaying as though wakened from a deep sleep. Then, with Piflet watching in stunned horror, he turned to face the desiccated corpse of what had been some great warrior, shambling out of the darkened door at the chamber's far end. Thargor's movements were slow and dreamy. He had barely raised Life Reaper when the armor-clad mummy brought its rusted battle-axe down on his head, splitting his skull to the first knob of his spine. Thargor fumbled in gray emptiness, Piflet's astonished cries still echoing in his memory. His own astonishment was no less.
I'm dead. I'm dead. How can I be dead?
It was beyond belief.
That was a lich. A stupid, sniveling lich. I've killed thousands of them. How could I get toasted by something as fringe as that?
He searched wildly for a moment as the gray nothing washed over him, but there were no solutions. Nothing to be done. The damage was too great. He exited, and was Orlando Gardner once more. Orlando pulled out his jack and sat up. He was so astounded by the turn of events that his hands moved in empty air for long moments before he unseeingly located, and then absently punched into shape, the pillows that cushioned his head, then reconfigured the bed so he could sit up. A cold sweat had pearled on his skin. His neck ached from being in one position too long. His head hurt, too, and the glare of midday through his bedroom window wasn't helping. He rasped a command and turned the window into a blank wall again. He needed to think. Thargor is dead. It was so shocking he found it hard to consider anything else, although there were many things to think about. He had made Thargor. He had made himself Thargor with the labor of 4 long, obsessive years. He had survived everything, developing a facility that was the envy of players everywhere on the net. He was the most famous character in the Middle Country game, recruited for every battle, first choice for every important task. Now Thargor was dead, his skull crushed by a ridiculous low-level irritant.
A lich, for God's sake!
The damned things were scattered around every dungeon and tomb in the Simworld, cheap and ubiquitous as candy wrappers. Orlando took a squeeze bottle from his bedside and drank. He felt feverish. His head throbbed, as though the tomb guardian's axe had truly struck him. Everything had happened with such boggling abruptness. That gleaming hole, that shining golden whatever it was, that had been something bigger, stranger by far than anything else in the adventure, in any adventure. Either one of his rivals had set the trap to end all traps, or something beyond his understanding had occurred. He had seen a city, a shining, majestic city, the color of sunlit amber. It had not been one of the pseudo-medieval walled cities that dotted the Simworld, the game territory known as the Middle Country. This vision had been alien, but relentlessly modern. A metropolis with elaborately decorated buildings as tall as anything in Hong Kong or Tokyohama. But it was more than some science fiction vision. There had been something real about the place, more real than anything he had ever seen on the net. Set against the careful fractals of the game world, it had glowed with its own splendid and superior presence, like a gemstone on a pile of dust. Morpher, Dieter Cabo, Duke Slowleft, how could any of Orlando's rivals have brought something like that into the Middle Country? Every spell point in the world wouldn't allow you to alter the basics of a simplace that way. The city had simply belonged to a level of reality higher than the game he had been playing. Higher even, it had almost seemed, than R.L. itself. That amazing city. It had to be a real place, or at least something other than net stuff. Orlando had spent almost his whole life on the net, knew it like a 19th-century Mississippi pilot knew the big river. This was something new, an entirely different order of experience. Someone, something, was trying to communicate with him. No wonder the Lich had been able to sneak up on him. Pithlit must have thought his companion had gone mad. Orlando frowned. He would have to call Fredericks and explain. But he wasn't quite ready to rehash things with Fredericks yet. There was too much to think about. Thargor, Orlando Gardner's alter ego, his more-than-self, was dead. And that was only one of his problems. What was a 14-year-old kid supposed to do after he'd been touched by the gods? Chapter 5. A World Afire. Netfeed News. Stuttgart Protest Memorial. Visual. Parade of people bearing candles. V.O. Thousands gathered in Stuttgart for a candlelight vigil to honor the 23 homeless people slain by German federal police in a riot over housing. Visual. Young man in tears. Head bloodied. Witness. They had body armor. Big spikes sticking out. They just kept coming and coming. Using a flat screen drove Reenie crazy. It was like boiling water over an open flame to wash clothes. Only in a miserable backwater hospital like this. She cursed and pushed on the screen again. This time it shot right past the S's and into the T's before she could arrest the scroll's progress. It shouldn't be this hard to get information. It was cruel, as if the bloody quarantine wasn't hindrance enough. Bukavu 4 information posters were everywhere in Pinetown these days, but most of them had been so densely covered with graffiti that she had never quite absorbed the content. She knew there had been outbreaks of the virus in Durban, and had even heard a pair of women talking about someone's daughter in Pinetown who had died of it after traveling in Central Africa. But Reenie would never have guessed that the entire Durban outskirt medical facility would be under official UN-mandated Bukavu outbreak quarantine procedures. If the disease is so damn dangerous, she thought, then what are they doing bringing sick people here who don't have it? She was furious to think that her brother, already struck down by some unknown illness, might be exposed to an even worse contagion in the place she had brought him for treatment. But even as she raged, she knew the reasons. She worked for a public institution herself. Funds were short. Funds were always short. If they could afford a hospital just to deal with Bukavu patients, they'd have one. The hospital administrators couldn't be very happy about trying to keep their normal operation running under quarantine restraints. Perhaps there was even a very thin silver lining. Durban still didn't have enough B4 cases to warrant devoting an entire hospital to their care. That was small solace, though. Reenie finally got the ancient interface to stop on the S's, and she punched in her visitor code. Sulawayo Stephen was listed as unchanged. which meant that she could visit him at least. But seeing Stephen these days was always heartbreakingly short of anything she would have called a visit. A nurse reading from a pad briefed her as she struggled into an ensuite, although there was little he could tell Renee that she had not gleaned from the single word on the monitor in the waiting room. She had become so familiar with the litany she could have recited it herself, so she let the nurse go when he had finished, despite the urge to hang on to any symbol of officialdom and beg for answers. Renee knew by now that there were no answers, no detectable viruses, including, thank God, no signs of the fatal disease that had forced the hospital into such heavy-handed security. No blood clots or other blockages, no trauma to the brain, nothing. Just a little brother who hadn't awakened for 22 days. She shuffled along the passageway, holding her air hose to keep it from catching on things. Groups of doctors and nurses, and possibly other visitors as well, since everyone looked pretty much the same in an ensuite, hurried past her, making the same crackling and hissing noises she made. It was a little like being in an old news video about manned space exploration. When she passed a large window, she almost expected to look out and see the star-flocked depths of space beyond, or perhaps the rings of Saturn. Instead, it was only another ward full of tented beds, another campground of the living dead. Renee was stopped twice on her way to the fourth floor and asked to produce her visitor's pass. Although both functionaries spent a long time examining the faint lettering, the effects of a dying printer exacerbated by Perspex face shields on the ensuits, she was not angered by the delay. In a way, she found it vaguely reassuring to know that the hospital really did care about the security of their quarantine. Stephen had been stricken so quickly and thoroughly, and so mysteriously, that it almost seemed like an act of malice. Renee was frightened for her baby brother, frightened of something she could not explain. She was relieved to see that people were on guard. Renee desperately wanted her brother to get better, but she was even more afraid of a turn for the worse when she found him lying in exactly the same position as the day before, and all the monitors still locked on readings that were now as familiar as her own address. She felt both unhappiness and relief.
"Oh, God, my poor little man."
He was so small in that big bed. How could a little tearaway like Stephen be so quiet, so still? And how could she, who had fed him, protected him, tucked him in at night, had in all ways except biology been a mother to him, how could she be so maddeningly unable to do anything for him now? It was not possible, but it was true. She sat beside his bed and put her own gloved hand into the larger glove built into the side of the tent. She carefully maneuvered her fingers past the tangle of sensor wires radiating from his scalp, then stroked his face, the familiar and beloved line of his rounded forehead, his upturned nose. She was heartsick at being so completely separated from him. It was like trying to touch someone in VR. They might as well be meeting in the inner district. A kindling of memory was interrupted by a movement at the doorway. Despite her own ensuit, she jumped at the white apparition.
"Sorry to startle you, Ms. Sulawayo. Oh, it's you. Any change?"
Dr. Chandar leaned forward and surveyed the monitor dials. But even Renee knew there was no information to be had there.
"Much the same, it seems. I am sorry."
Renee shrugged, a resigned gesture belied by the heaviness in her gut, the warm imminence of tears. But crying was useless. All she would do was fog the faceplate.
"Why can't anyone tell me what's wrong?"
The doctor shook her head, or at least moved the hood of her ensuit from side to side.
"You're an educated woman, Miss Sulawayo. Sometimes medical science does not have answers, only guesses. At the moment, our guesses are not very good, but things may change. At least your brother's condition is stable."
Stable.
So is a potted plant.
Now the tears did come. She turned to face Stephen again, although at the moment she could see nothing. A gloved, inhuman hand touched her shoulder.
"I am sorry. We are doing all we can."
"What is that exactly?" Renee struggled to keep her voice steady, but she could not help sniffling. How is a person supposed to blow her nose in one of these bloody suits?
"Please tell me, what are you doing, besides putting him in the sun and keeping him watered?"
"Your brother's case is rare, but not unique."
Dr. Chandar's voice was pitched in the telltale, dealing with difficult family members mode.
"There have been, and are, other children who have fallen into this sort of comatose state without apparent cause. Some of them have spontaneously recovered. just woke up one day and asked for something to drink or eat. And the others, the ones who didn't just sit up and demand ice cream?
The doctor removed her hand from Rini's shoulder.
We are doing our best, Miss Sulawayo, and there is nothing you can do except what you are doing. Coming here so that Stephen can feel your touch and hear your familiar voice.
I know. You told me. Which means I should be talking to Stephen instead of haranguing you. Rini took a shaky breath. The tears had stopped flowing, but her faceplate was still steamy.
I don't mean to take it out on you, Doctor. I know you've got a lot to worry about. This has not been a particularly good time these past few months. I wonder sometimes why I picked a career with so much sadness in it.
Dr. Chandar turned at the doorway.
But it is good to make a difference, and sometimes I do. And sometimes, Miss Sulawayo, there are wonderful moments of happiness. I hope you and I can share one of those when Stephen comes back to us.
Rini watched the dim white form shuffle out into the corridor. The door slid closed again. The maddening thing was, although she was aching for someone to fight with, for someone to accuse, there was no one. The doctors were doing their best. The hospital, despite its limitations, had given Stephen almost every test that might help explain what had struck him down. None had. There were no answers. There was truly no one to blame, except God, she thought. Perhaps. But that had never done anyone much good, and perhaps Long Joseph Sulawayo was not entirely without responsibility in the matter either. Rini touched Stephen's face again. She hoped that somewhere deep inside that unresponsive body, he could feel and hear her, even through two layers of quarantine.
I have a book, Stephen. Not one of my favorites this time, but one of yours.
She smiled sadly. She was always trying to get him to read African things. Stories, history, folk tales from the mixed tribal legacy of their family. She wanted him to be proud of his heritage in a world where such holdovers were fast disappearing, crushed in the inexorable glacial flow of first-world culture. But Stephen's tastes had never run that way. She thumbed on her pad, then increased the size of the text so she could see it through brimming eyes. She blanked the pictures. She didn't want to see them, and Stephen couldn't.
It's Net Surfer Detectives,
she said, and began to read.
Malibu Hyperblock is completely sealed, shouted Masker as he crashed through the door, letting his skimboard zoom off into the other room with none of his usual care. The Zingray 220 knocked several other boards loose as it tried to fit itself back into the rack. Masker ignored the clatter, more concerned with his news.
They've got Big Mama recognizers on every flow point.
That's some vicious bad wanton, said Scoop.
He left his hollow-striped pad floating in midair as he turned to his excited friend.
I mean, there must be major trouble. Double sampled. If you would just go and see him.
Long Joseph put his hands to his head as though to shut out the noise.
I did go, didn't I?
Twice. You've been twice. The day after I took him there, and when the doctor made you come down for a conference.
What more you want? He's sick. You think I should go down every day like you do, look at him? He's still sick. Visit him all you want. It don't make him better.
Rini seethed. How could anyone be so impossible? He's your son, Papa. He's just a kid. He's all by himself in that hospital.
And he don't know nothing. I went and talked to him. He don't know nothing. What good is all your talking, talking? You even read him books.
Because a familiar voice might help him find his way back.
She paused and prayed for strength to the God of her trusting childhood, a kinder God than any she could summon belief for these days.
And maybe it's your voice he needs to hear most, Papa. The doctor said so.
His look became vulpine, his eyes darting to the side as though seeking escape.
What's that nonsense mean?
He had a fight with you. You were angry with him, told him not to come back. Now something has happened to him, and maybe, somewhere deep down, like a dream, he's scared to come back. Maybe he thinks you're mad at him, and so he's staying away.
Long Joseph pushed himself up off the couch, frightened, but trying to cover it with bluster.
You can't talk to me like that, girl. And no doctor talks to me like that about my business either.
He stamped his way into the kitchen and began to open cupboards.
A lot of craziness. Scared of me. I just set him straight. Didn't even lay no hand to him.
There isn't any.
The cupboard rifling noises stopped.
What?
There isn't any. I didn't buy you any wine.
Don't tell me what I'm looking for!
Fine. Do what you like. Weenie's head hurt, and she was so tired she didn't want to get out of her chair until the arrival of tomorrow morning forced her. Between working, commuting, and visiting Stephen, she was spending at least 14 hours a day out of the house. So much for the information century. Every time you turned around, you had to go somewhere, see someone, usually on aching feet because the bloody trains weren't running. The cyber age. What shit? Long Joseph reappeared in the living room.
I'm going out. The man deserves some peace.
Weenie decided to make one last try. Listen, Papa, whatever you think, it would do Stephen good to hear your voice. Come with me to visit him. He raised his hand as if to swing at something, then pressed it over his eyes for a long moment. When he took it away, his face was full of despair.
Go there, he said hoarsely. So I should go there and watch my son die.
Weenie was shocked. He's not dying.
Oh? He jumping and running? He playing football?
Long Joseph stretched his arms wide. His jaw worked furiously.
No. He is lying in hospital just like his mama. You were with your grandmother, girl. You weren't there. I sat there for 3 weeks and watched your mama all burned up in that bed. Tried to give her water when she cried. Watched her die slowly.
He blinked several times, then abruptly turned his back on her, his shoulders hunched as though against the blow of a shambok. His voice, when it came, was almost a different person's.
I spent plenty of time in that damn hospital.
Stunned, her own eyes abruptly welling, Weenie could not speak for a moment. Papa? He would not turn to face her.
Enough, girl. I'll go see him. I'm his father. You don't need to tell me my job.
You will? Will you come with me tomorrow? He made an angry sound in his throat.
I've got things to do. I'll let you know when I'm coming.
She tried to be gentle. Please make it soon, Papa. He needs you.
I'll see him, damn you. Put on that foolish suit again. But don't tell me when to go.
Still unwilling or unable to meet her eyes, he thumbed the door open and went lurching out. Drained of energy, full of confusion, Weenie sat for a long time staring at the closed door. Something had just happened, but she wasn't quite sure what it had been or what it had meant. For a moment she had felt something like a connection with the father she had known, the man who had labored so hard to keep the family together after his wife died, who had worked extra jobs and encouraged her studies, and even tried to help Weenie and her grandmother Uma Bongela with little Stephen. But after her Uma had died, and Weenie had become a grown woman, he had just given up. The Long Joseph she had known seemed completely lost. Weenie sighed. Whether that was true or not, she just didn't have the strength to deal with it right now. She slumped deeper in the chair, squinting against the throb of her headache. She had forgotten to buy more pain blockers, of course. And if she didn't take care of something, no one else was going to. She turned on the wall screen and let the first thing she had queued up, a travelogue about holidays in Tasmania, wash over her, deadening her thoughts. For a brief moment, she wished she had one of those expensive, full-sensory wraparounds, so she could go to that beach, smell the apple blossoms, feel the sand beneath her feet, and the air of holiday freedom so expensively encoded into the program. Anything to avoid the recursive memory of her father's hunched shoulders and of Stephen's sightless eyes. When the beeping awoke her, Weenie grabbed at her pad. 8 in the morning. But that wasn't her wake-up alarm. Was it the hospital? Answer! She shouted. Nothing happened. As she struggled into a sitting position, Weenie finally realized that the noise was coming not from the phone, but from the front door speaker. She pulled on a bathrobe and made her way groggily across the living room. Her chair was lying on its side like the desiccated corpse of some strange animal, victim of Long Joseph's late and drunken return. She leaned on the switch. Hello? Miss Sulawayo? It is Habu speaking. I am sorry to disturb you. Habu? What are you doing here? I will explain. It is nothing bad or frightening. She looked around at the apartment, messy at the best of times, but now showing the effects of her cumulative absences. Her father's snores rumbled from his bedroom. I'll be down. Wait for me. Habu seemed perfectly normal,
except that he was wearing a very clean white shirt. Rini looked him up and down, confused and a little off balance.
"I hope I am not disturbing you too much," he said, smiling. "I was at school early this morning. I like it when it is quiet, but then there was a bomb."
"Another one? Oh, God."
"Not a real one. At least, I do not know. But a telephone warning. They emptied the Polytechnic. I thought you might not know, so I decided I would save you a useless trip."
"Thank you. Hang on for a moment." She took out her pad and browsed the college system for mail. There was a general message from the chancellor declaring the poly closed until further notice. So Habu had saved her a trip. But she suddenly wondered why he had not merely called her. She looked up. He was still smiling. It was almost impossible to imagine deception lurking behind those eyes. But why had he come all the way out to Pinetown? She noted the ironed creases in the white shirt and had a sudden disorienting thought. Was this romance? Had the little tribesman come out here to take her on some kind of date? She didn't know quite how she felt about that, but the word uncomfortable sprang to mind.
"Well," she said slowly, "since the poly is closed, I guess you have the day off."
Her use of the singular pronoun was intentional.
"Then I would like to take my instructor out for a meal. Breakfast?"
Habu's smile wavered, then flickered out, replaced by a look of disconcerting intensity.
"You have been very sad, Miss Rini. You have been very sad, but you have been a good friend to me. I believe it is you who now needs a friend." "I think..."
She hesitated, but could think of no good reason not to go. It was just 8:30 in the morning, and the apartment seemed poisonous. Her little brother was lying in an oxygen tent, as unreachable as if he were dead, and the thought of being in the same kitchen with her father when he floundered to consciousness in a few hours made her neck and shoulders tighten like a pulled knot.
"Right," she said. "Let's go."
If there was romance on Habu's mind, he certainly didn't show it. As they walked down into Pinetown's business section, he seemed to be looking at everything but Rini. His half-closed eyes, that could so easily look shy or sleepy, flitting across peeling paint and boarded-up windows, watching rubbish blow down the wide streets like cartoon tumbleweeds.
"It's not a very nice part of town, I'm afraid."
"My landlady's house is in Chesterville," he replied. "This is a little more wealthy, although fewer people seem to be on the streets. But what astonishes me, and I must confess, Rini, horrifies me a little, is the humanness of it all."
"What does that mean?"
"Is that not a word? Humanness? Humanity, perhaps? What I mean is that everything here, all of the city that I have seen since leaving my people, is built to block out the earth, to hide it from sight and mind. The rocks have been scoured away, the bush burned off, and everything has been covered with tar."
He slapped his thong-soled foot against the cracked street.
"Even the few trees, like that sad fellow there, have been brought here and planted by people. Humans turn the places they live into great crowded piles of mud and stone, like the nests termites build. But what happens when in all the world there are only termite hills left, but no bush?"
Rini shook her head.
"What else should we do? If this were bush country, there would be too many of us to survive. We would starve. We would kill each other."
"So what will people do when they finally run out of bush to burn?"
Habu bent and picked up a plastic ring, an already unclassifiable remnant of the current civilization. He squeezed his fingers together and slipped it over his wrist, then held his new bangle up and examined it, a sour half-smile on his lips.
"Starve, then? Kill each other, then? It will be the same problem. But first we will have covered everything with tar and stone and cement and, what is it called, fibramic? Also, when the killing comes, there will be many more people to die."
"We'll go into space."
Rini gestured toward the gray sky.
"We'll, I don't know, colonize other planets."
Habu nodded.
"Ah."
Johnny's cafe was crowded. Most of the customers were truck drivers starting their hauling day on the Durban-Pretoria route, big, friendly men in sunglasses and bright-colored shirts. Too friendly, some of them. In the time it took to squeeze through to an empty booth, Rini received a proposal of marriage and several less honorable offers. She clenched her teeth, refusing to smile at even the most harmless and respectful of the flirts. If you encouraged them, it just got worse. But there were things Rini liked about Johnny's, and one of them was that you could get real food. So many of the small restaurants and coffee shops these days served nothing but American-style convenience food.
waved beef burgers, sausages in rolls with gluey cheese sauce, and, of course, Coca-Cola and fries, the wafer and wine of the Western religion of commerce. But somebody in the kitchen here, perhaps Johnny himself, if there was such a person, actually cooked. Besides the cup of strong driver fuel coffee, Rini decided on bread with butter and honey and a plate of fried plantains and rice. Khabu let her order him the same. When the wide platter came, he stared at it in apparent dismay. "It is so large. It's mostly starch. Don't finish it if you don't feel comfortable." "Will you eat it?" She laughed. "Thanks, but this is plenty for me." "Then what will happen to it?" Rini paused. Distant stepchild to the culture of wealth, she had never thought much about her own patterns of consumption and waste. "I'm sure someone in the kitchen takes home whatever's left over," she offered at last, and felt guilty and shamed even as she said it. She had little doubt that the one-time masters of South Africa had made the same excuse as they watched the remains of another Caligulean feast being cleared away. She was grateful that Khabu did not seem inclined to follow up the question. It was at moments like this that she realized how different his outlook truly was. He spoke better English than her father, and his intelligence and quick empathy aided him in understanding many very subtle things. But he was not like her, not at all. He might have dropped in from another planet. Rini, again with an obscure feeling of shame, realized that she shared more of her fundamental outlook with a rich white teenager living in England or America than with this young African man who had grown up a few hundred miles away. After he had eaten a few mouthfuls of rice, Khabu looked up. "I have now been in two cafes," he said. "This and the one in the Lambda Mall." "Which do you prefer?" He grinned. "The food is better here." He took another bite, then poked at a glistening plantain with his fork, as if to make sure it was dead. "There is something else, too. You remember I asked about ghosts on the net? I see the life there, but I cannot feel it, which makes me uneasy in spirit. It is hard to explain, but I like this place much better." Rini had been a net habitué for so long that she sometimes did indeed think of it as a place, a huge place, but just as geographically real as Europe or Australia. But Khabu was right. It wasn't. It was an agreement, something people pretended was real. In some ways it was a country of ghosts, but all the ghosts were haunting each other. "There is something to be said for R.L. As if to prove it to herself, she lifted her mug of very good, very strong coffee. "No question. Now please, Rini, tell me what is troubling you. You said to me that your brother was ill. Is that it? Or have you other problems as well? I hope I am not intruding too much." Awkwardly at first, she described her last visit to Stephen, and the latest version of her ongoing argument with Long Joseph. Once she began, it grew easier to talk, to describe the hopeless frustration of visiting Stephen every day when nothing ever changed, of the increasingly painful spiral of her relationship with her father. Khabu listened, asking questions only when she hesitated on the brink of some painful admission. But each time she answered the questions, and found herself moving farther into revelation. She was not used to opening herself, to exposing her secret fears. It felt dangerous. But as they dawdled through breakfast, and the morning crowd slowly drifted out of the coffee shop, she also felt relief at finally being able to speak. She was putting sweetener into her third cup of coffee when Khabu suddenly asked, "Are you going to see him today, your brother?"
"I usually go in the evening, after work.
May I come with you?" Rini hesitated, wondering for the first time since they had sat down whether Khabu's interest was something other than mere comradeship. She lit a cigarette to cover the pause. Did he see himself becoming the man in her life? Her protector? There hadn't been anyone significant since Delray, and that relationship, it was astonishing and somewhat frightening to realize, was years in the past. Except for brief moments of weakness in the small hours, she did not want anyone to take care of her. She had been strong all her life, and could not imagine giving responsibility over to someone else. In any case, she had no romantic feelings for this small young man. She looked at him for a long time as he, perhaps giving her a chance to do just that, examined the multicolored trucks ranked outside the dirty cafe window.
"What are you afraid of, girl?"
she asked herself.
"He's a friend. Take him at his word until he proves otherwise."
"Yes, come along."
It would be nice to have company.
He turned his gaze back to her, suddenly shy. I have never been to a hospital, but that is not why I wish to accompany you, he said hurriedly. I wish to meet your brother.
I wish you could meet him. Meet him the way he was. Is.
She blinked hard.
I sometimes find it hard to believe he's in there. It's so painful to see him like that.
Habu nodded solemnly. I wonder whether it is more difficult your way, where your loved one is far from you. Among my people, the sick ones stay with us. But perhaps the frustration would be greater if you had to watch him always, every day, remaining in this sad state.
I don't think I could take it. I wonder how the other families deal with it.
Other families? Of the sick?
Of children like Stephen. His doctor said there were quite a few other cases.
Something like a shock ran through her as she realized what she was saying. For the first time in several days, the feeling of helplessness, which even Habu's patient listening had not much affected, suddenly receded.
I'm not going to do it anymore, she said.
Habu looked up, startled by the change in her voice. Not do what?
Just sit and worry. Wait for someone to tell me something, when I could be doing something myself. Why did this happen to Stephen?
The little man was confused. I am no city doctor, Rini.
That's just it. You don't know? I don't know. The doctors don't know. But there are other cases. They said so. Stephen is being treated in a hospital that's under Bukavu 4 quarantine, and the doctors there are being worked to exhaustion. Couldn't they have missed something? How much research have they had a chance to do? Real research.
She slid her card into the table, then thumbprinted the scuffed screen.
Do you want to come to the Poly with me?
But it is closed today.
Damn.
She replaced the card in her pocket.
That's all right. The net access is still available. I just need a station.
She considered her home system and balanced the convenience against the likelihood that her father would just now be staggering out into the kitchen. Even if, against all odds, he was not hungover and foul-tempered, she knew that bringing Habu home with her would mean she would be hearing about her Bushman boyfriend for months.
My friend,
she said as she stood up,
we're going to visit the Pinetown Public Library. We could get most of this off my pad,
she explained as the chubby young librarian unlocked the net room.
Or yours, for that matter. But we'd be getting text and flat pictures. And I don't like working that way.
Habu followed her in. The librarian eyed the bushman over the top of his glasses, shrugged, then strolled back to the desk. The few old men watching the news on kiosk screens had already turned back to the full-color footage of the most recent maglev train accident on the Deccan Plateau in India. Rini closed the door, shutting out the distractions of crushed metal, sacked bodies, and the reporter's breathless commentary. She pulled a sad tangle of cables out of the storage cabinet, then searched through the obsolescent headsets until she found two that were in reasonable shape. She slid her fingers into the squeezers and keyed up net access. I see nothing, Habu said. Rini pushed up her helmet, then leaned over and tinkered with Habu's faceplate until she found the loose connection. She pulled her own helmet back on, and the gray of raw net space surrounded her. I have no body.
You won't. This is an information-only ride, and quite stripped down at that. No force feedback, so no sensation of touching anything. This is about what you get on a cheap home system, like the kind an instructor at the Poly can afford.
She tightened her fingers, and the gray deepened into a blackness that, except for the absence of stars, might have been deep space.
I should have done this a long time ago, she said, but I've been so busy, so tired.
Done what? Habu's tone remained calm, but she could sense a little tension underneath the patience. Well, she decided, he would just have to hang on. He was riding in her car.
Done a little research myself, she said. 24-hour access to the greatest information system the world has ever known, and I've been letting someone else do my thinking for me.
She squeezed, and a ball of glowing blue light appeared, like a propane sun at the heart of an empty universe.
This unit should have a fix on my voice by now, she said,
then calmly enunciated,
Medical information. Let's get cracking.
After she had issued a few more commands, a supine human form appeared, hovering in the empty space before them, a strangely vacant figure as rudimentary as an inexpensive sim. Threads of light snaked through it, illuminating the circulatory system as a calm female voice described clot formation and subsequent oxygen deprivation to the brain.
Like gods!
Habu sounded slightly perturbed.
Nothing is hidden.
We're wasting time here, Rini said, ignoring him. We know that there's no pathological indication in Stephen. Even his brain chemical levels are normal, let alone anything as grossly obvious as a clot or a tumor. Let's get out of this Encyclopedia Britannica stuff and start looking for real information. Medical journals. Today's date to minus 12 months. Keywords and or coma. Children. Juvenile. What else? Brain trauma. Stupor.
Rini had hung a glimmering time display just at the comfortable upper range of her vision. Most of the access calls were local, since most of the information was directly available on the main net infobanks. But some of the downloads were costing her, and the resource-starved Pinetown Library was going to add on a time-based surcharge. They had been online for over 3 hours, and she still had not found anything that made her feel the search had been worthwhile. Habu had stopped asking questions at least an hour earlier, either overwhelmed by the dizzying, shifting displays of information, or just bored.
Only a few thousand cases like this altogether, she said. Everything else, known causes. Out of 10 billion people, that's not many.
Distribution map. Reported cases in red.
Might as well look at that again.
The array of glowing lines dissolved and were replaced by a stylized globe of the earth shining with inner light. A fruit, round and perfect, falling through emptiness.
And how could we ever find another planet like this?
She asked herself, remembering what she had said to Habu about colonization.
The greatest gift possible, and we have taken very poor care of it.
A series of glowing scarlet dots appeared across the globe, spreading like mold as they replicated the chronological onset of incidents. The sequence showed no pattern that she could see, appearing in what seemed like random order all over the simulated Earth, with no reference to proximity. If it was an epidemic, it was a very strange one. Rini frowned. When all the dots were lit, the pattern still suggested nothing. The dots were thickest in the most populated areas, which was not surprising. In the first world countries of Europe, America, and the Pacific Rim, they were fewer in number, but scattered widely over the land masses. Across the third world, the spots clustered almost entirely along the seacoasts and bays and rivers, in hot red infestations that made her think of skin disease. For a moment, she thought she might have discovered something, some link to polluted waters, discarded toxins.
Environmental contaminant levels above UN-prescribed guidelines, she said.
Purple. As the lavender dots ignited, Rini stared.
Shit!
Habu's voice came to her from the darkness. What is wrong?
The purple are sites of strong pollutant contamination. See how the coma cases are clustered along the seacoasts and rivers, here and in southern Asia? I thought there might be a link, but that pattern doesn't hold true in America. Half the cases are far away from any high contaminant levels. The first world doesn't have anywhere near as many cases, but I find it hard to believe there'd be two separate causes, one for them, one for us.
She sighed.
Purple off. Maybe there are two separate causes. Maybe there are hundreds.
She thought for a moment.
Population density, in yellow.
As the little yellow lights bloomed, she swore again.
That's what all the rivers and coastline cases were about. That's where most of the big cities are, of course. I should have thought of that 20 minutes ago.
Perhaps you are tired, Rini, Habu suggested. It has been some time since you ate, and you have been working very hard.
I'm just about to give up.
She stared at the globe pocked with red and yellow lights. End of Side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 4. City of Golden Shadow. Other Land, Volume 1. By Tad Williams. Continuing on page 98.
But it's strange, Habu. Even with population density, it still doesn't make sense. Almost all the cases in Africa, northern Eurasia, India, are in heavily populated areas. But in the first world, they're a little thicker around the major metroplexes. But there are cases all over the place, too. Look at all those red dots across the middle of America.
You are trying to find something that corresponds with the children who have gone into comas like Stevens. Yes? Something that people do or experience or suffer from, which might have a connection?
Yes, but ordinary disease vectors don't seem to have anything to do with it. Pollutants don't either. There's no rhyme or reason I can see. I even thought for a moment it might have something to do with electromagnetic disturbances. You know, the kind you get from power transformers. But virtually all of India and Africa went through electrification years ago. So if EMD was causing these comas,
Why would they happen only in the urban areas? What do you get only around the urban metroplexes in the Third World, but all over the First World?
The globe hung before her, the lights mysterious as words written in an unknown alphabet. It was hopeless. Too many questions. No answers. She began to key the exit sequence.
Another way to think of it, Khabu said suddenly, is what things do you not find in the places that city dwellers call undeveloped?
There was a forcefulness to his tone, as though he were conveying important information, and yet he sounded strangely distant, too.
Rini, what do you not find in places like my Okavango Delta?
At first, she did not understand what he meant.
Then something moved through her like a cold wind. Show me areas of net usage.
Her voice was only a little shaky.
Minimum 2 hours per day per household. In orange.
The new indicators sparked into existence. A swarm of tiny flames that turned the globe into a spherical conflagration. At the center of almost every bright smear of orange was at least one angry red spot.
Oh, my God,
she whispered.
Oh, my God, they match.
Chapter 6. No Man's Land. Netfeed, fashion. Mbinda brings street to catwalk. Visual, Mbinda's spring show. Runway models. V.O. Designer Hussein Mbinda has declared this street year, and backed up those words with his spring showing in Milan, where the hammocks of the homeless and the shoots identified with urban goggle boys were recreated in the latest synthomorphic fabrics.
Visual, Mbinda speaking from cardboard shanty.
Mbinda, the street is with us. It is in us. You cannot ignore it. Her breath was like cinnamon. Her long-fingered hand on his breast seemed to weigh no more than a leaf. He kept his eyes closed, afraid that if he opened them she would vanish, as she had so many times before.
Have you forgotten?
A whisper, faint and sweet as birdsong in a far-off wood. No, I haven't forgotten.
Then come back to us, Paul. Come back to us.
As her sadness swept through him, he lifted his arms to clutch her. I haven't forgotten, he said. I haven't. An explosive crash jerked Paul Jonas upright. One of the German 11-inchers had roared into life. The earth shook resentfully, and the trench timbers creaked as the first shell struck a quarter of a mile down the line. Very pistol flares drifted across the sky, painting the shell trails bright red. A shimmer of rain spattered Paul's face. His arms were empty. I haven't, he said stupidly. He held his hands before him and stared at the flare-lit mud that covered them. Haven't what? Finch was hunched a yard away, writing a letter home. Scarlet flickered across the lenses of his spectacles as he turned toward Paul. Having a good one, were you? Was she pretty? The force of his stare belied his light tone. Paul looked away in embarrassment. Why was his comrade looking at him like that? It had just been a dream, hadn't it? Another one of those dreams that plagued him so insistently? A woman? A sorrowful angel? Am I going mad? Is that why Finch stares at me? He sat up, grimacing. A puddle had formed beneath his boots as he slept, soaking his feet. If he didn't attend to them, he'd get trench foot. Bad enough to have people you didn't know and couldn't see tossing bits of exploding metal at you without having to watch your own extremities rot away before your eyes. He pulled off his boots and pushed them over to the tiny gas stove, tongues pulled down so they would dry faster. But faster than never could still be awfully slow, he thought. The damp was an even more patient enemy than the Germans. It didn't take an evening off to celebrate Christmas or Easter, and all the guns and bombs the Fifth Army could deploy wouldn't kill it. It just seeped back in, filling trenches, graves, boots, filling people, too. Trench soul, when all that makes you a person festers and dies. His feet looked pale as skinned animals, ragged and soft. They were bruised blue along the toes where the blood wasn't circulating properly. He leaned forward to rub them, and noted with a mixture of abstract interest and quiet horror that he couldn't feel either the toes or the fingers that squeezed them. "What day is today?" he asked. Finch looked up, surprised by the question. "Strike me blind, Jonesy, how should I know? Ask Mullet. He's keeping track 'cause he's got leave coming." On Finch's far side, Mullet's rounded bulk rose into view, a rhino disturbed at the waterhole. His close-cropped head turned slowly toward Paul. "What do you want?"
I just asked what day it is.
The bombardment had stuttered to a halt. His voice sounded unnaturally loud. Mullet made a face, as though Paul had asked him the distance to the moon in nautical miles.
It's March 20th, innit? 36 more days until I go back to Blighty. What the hell do you care?
Paul shook his head. It sometimes seemed that it had always been March 1918, that he had always lived in this trench with Mullet and Finch and the rest of the grumbling remnants of Seventh Corps.
Jonesy was having that dream again, Finch said.
He and Mullet shared a brief look. They did think he was going mad. Paul was sure of it.
Who was she, Jonesy? That little barmaid from the Estaminet? Or Mrs. Entroyer's little Madeleine?
He offered the names with his usual contempt for French pronunciation.
She's too young for you, old mate. Barely big enough to bleed, that one. For Christ's sake, shut up!
Paul turned away in disgust. He picked up his boots and moved them so that each side would receive an equal proportion of the scant warmth from the Primus stove.
Jones is a romantic!
Mullet brayed. He had teeth to complement his rhinoceroid physique. Flat, wide, and yellow.
Don't you know that every man in the Seventh except you has had that Madeleine already? I said shut up, Mullet. I don't want to talk.
The big man grinned again, then slumped back into the shadows beyond Finch, who turned to Jonas. There was more than a little anger in the slender man's voice as he said,
Why don't you just go back to sleep, Jonesy? Don't make trouble. There's plenty of that around already.
Paul took off his greatcoat, then pushed himself farther down the trench until he found a place where his feet would be less likely to get wet. He bundled the coat around his bare toes and leaned back against the duckboards. He knew he shouldn't get mad at his companions. Hell, his friends, the only friends he had. But the threat of a last-ditch German assault had been hanging over all their heads for days. Between the constant barrages meant to soften them up, the anticipation of something worse to come, and the dreams that would not leave him alone, well, it was little wonder he felt like his nerves were on fire. Paul stole a glance at Finch, who was bending over his letter again, squinting in the dim lantern light. Reassured, he turned his back to his trenchmates and pulled the green feather from his pocket. Although the very light was fading, the feather seemed to have its own faint radiance. He held it close to his face and breathed deeply. But whatever scent it had once held was gone, overwhelmed by the odors of tobacco, sweat, and mud. It meant something, this feather, although he couldn't say what. He didn't remember picking it up, but it had been in his pocket for days. Somehow it reminded him of the angel dream, but he wasn't sure why. More likely the dreams were sparked by the possession of the feather, and the dreams themselves were very strange. He remembered only fragments. The angel and her haunting voice, some kind of machine trying to kill him, but he felt somehow that even these fragments were precious, insubstantial good luck charms he could not afford to be without. Clutching at straws, Jonas, he told himself, clutching at feathers. He slid the shiny object back into his pocket. Dying men think of funny things, and that's what we all are here, aren't we? Dying men? He tried to smooth the thought away. Such ruminations would not slow his tired heart or ease his trembling muscles. He closed his eyes and began the slow search for the path that would take him back down to sleep. Somewhere on the other side of No Man's Land, the guns began to roar again. Come to us.
Paul woke up as a great crash split the sky.
The sweat that covered his forehead and cheeks was sluiced away by a sweeping wash of rain. The sky lit up, the clouds suddenly white at the edges and burning behind. Another powerful roll of thunder followed. It was not the guns. It was not an attack at all, but only nature pointing out heavy-handed parallels. Paul sat up. 2 yards away, Finch lay like a dead man, his greatcoat pulled over his head and shoulders. A flare of lightning showed a row of sleeping forms beyond him. Come to us. The dream voice still echoed in his ears. He had felt her again, so close. An angel of mercy, come to whisper to him, come to summon him. Where? To heaven? Was that what it was? An omen of his coming death? Paul put his hands over his ears as the thunder cracked again, but could not shut out the noise or ease the ache in his skull. He would die here. He had long been resigned to that miserable promise. It would be peace anyway, a quiet rest. But now he suddenly knew that death would be no relief. Something worse waited for him beyond death's threshold. Something far worse.
It had something to do with the angel, although he could not believe any evil of her. A fit of shivering racked him. Something beyond death was hunting for him. He could almost see it. It had eyes and teeth, and it would swallow him down into its belly where he would be torn and chewed forever. Terror climbed up out of the pit of his stomach and into his throat. As the lightning flashed again, he opened his mouth wide, then choked as water filled it. When he had spluttered it out again, he screamed helplessly, but his voice disappeared in the throbbing bellow of the storm. The night, the storm, the nameless terrors of dream and death all closed in on him. "Think about getting out," a voice in another half-remembered dream had urged him. "About really getting out." He clutched at that memory as at something warm. In that collapsing moment, it was his only coherent thought. Paul staggered to his feet and took a few steps down the trench, away from the rest of his platoon, then grabbed the rungs of the nearest ladder and climbed, as if to throw himself into enemy fire. But he was fleeing death, not running toward it. He hesitated at the top. Desertion. If his comrades caught him, they would shoot him. He had seen it happen. Watched them execute a red-haired Geordie who had refused to go over on a raid. The boy hadn't been more than 15 or 16, lied about his age when he volunteered, and he had apologized and cried steadily until the rifle squad's bullets punched into him, changing him in an instant from a human being to a leaking sack of meat. The wind howled, and the rain flew horizontally before him as Paul pushed his head above the top of the trench. Let them shoot him then. Let either side shoot him if they could catch him. He was mad, mad as Lear. The storm had swept his senses away, and he suddenly felt free, getting out. Paul stumbled off the top of the ladder and fell. The sky flared again. Great sagging coils of barbed wire stretched horizontally before him, running all along the front of the trenches, protecting the Tommies from German raids. Beyond that lay no man's land, and past that haunted place, as though a great mirror had been stretched across the western front, lay the dark twin of the British lines. Fritz had hung out his own wire, protecting the pits in which he crouched in his multiform sameness. Which way to go? Which of two nearly hopeless alternatives to choose? Forward across the wasteland on a night when the German sentries and snipers might be huddled behind their walls, or back across his own lines toward free France? The infantryman's inbred horror of the void between the armies almost ruled him, but the wind was wild, and his blood seemed to respond to it, to urge a similar freedom from restraint. No one would expect him to go forward. He ran blindly through the rain, bent like an ape, until he was a few hundred yards from his platoon's entrenchment. As he crouched before the wire and took his cutters from his belt, he heard someone laughing quietly. He froze in terror before he realized that the person laughing had been him. The loose wire tore at his clothes as he pushed through, like the sentry brambles around a sleeping princess's castle. Paul flattened himself into the mud as another blaze of lightning turned the sky white. Thunder followed swiftly. The storm was coming closer. He crawled forward on knees and elbows, his head full of noise. Stay in no man's land. Somewhere there will be a place to break out again. Somewhere. Stay between the lines. The world was all mud and wire. The war in the heavens was only a faint imitation of the horror men had learned to make. He couldn't find up. He'd lost it. Paul rubbed at his face, trying to clear the muck from his eyes. But there was always more. He was swimming in it. There was nothing solid to push against, no resistance to tell him, here is the ground. He was drowning. He stopped struggling, and lay with his hand cupped over his mouth to keep the mud out while he breathed. Somewhere, far to his left, a machine gun started up, its scratchy chatter a faint counterpoint to the wind and rumbling storm. He slowly tilted his head from side to side until the dizziness and confusion abated. Think. Think! He was somewhere in no man's land, trying to crawl south between the lines. The darkness, striped by lightning and flares, that was the sky. The deeper darkness, giving light only from reflections in standing water, was the war-tortured earth. He, Private Paul Jonas, deserter, traitor, was clinging to that latter darkness like a flea on the back of a dying dog. He was on his belly. No surprise there. He had been on his belly forever, hadn't he? He dug in with his elbows and feet and pushed himself forward through the muck.
The years-long bombardment had churned the mud of No Man's Land into a million peaks and troughs, an endless, frozen, shit-brown sea. He had been crawling through it for hours, awkward and mechanical as an injured beetle. Every cell in his body screamed for him to hurry, to get clear, to drag himself out of this no-place, this bleak and lifeless land. But there was no way he could move faster. To rise was to expose himself to eyes and guns on either side. He could only crawl, inch by miserable inch, groveling his way beneath shrapnel and storm. Something hard was under his fingers. A flash of lightning revealed the skeletal head of a horse pushing up from the mud, like something born of sowing the Hydra's teeth. He jerked back the hand that had rested on its snout, on the stony teeth exposed behind shriveled lips. Its eyes were long gone, the sockets full of mud. A crooked fence of boards protruded from the earth behind it, the remains of the ammunition limber it had drawn. Strange to think, almost impossible to think, that this hellish place had once been a country road, a quiet part of quiet France. A horse like this would have clopped by with wagon in tow, taking a farmer to market, delivering milk or mail to village houses, when things made sense. Things had made sense once. He couldn't quite remember such a time, but he could not let himself believe anything else. The world had been an ordered place. Now country roads, houses, cart horses, all the things that once had separated civilization from encroaching darkness were being crushed together into a homogeneous primordial ooze. Houses, horses, people, the past, the dead. In the off-and-on glare of lightning he saw himself surrounded by the twisted corpses of soldiers. His fellow Tommies, perhaps, or Germans, there was no way to tell. Nationality, dignity, breath, all had been ripped away. Like a Christmas pudding stuffed with shillings, the mud was salted with incomplete fractions of life, bits of arms and legs, torsos with extremities cauterized by shell blast, boots with feet still in them, rags of uniform glued to shreds of skin. Other, more complete bodies lay among the pieces, bomb broken and flung like dolls, first swallowed by the ocean of viscous soil, and then exposed by the driving rain. Eyes stared blankly, mouths gaped. They were drowning, all drowning in muck, and everything everywhere, whether it had once lived or not, was the same horrible excremental color. It was the Slough of Despond. It was the ninth circle of hell. And if there was no salvation at the end of it, then the universe was a terrible, ill-constructed joke. Shivering and moaning, Paul crawled on, his back against the angry sky. A tremendous concussion knocked him down into the ooze. The ground lurched, engulfing him. As he swam back toward the air, he heard another whistling shriek, and the earth heaved again. 200 yards away, the impact sent up a huge gout of mud. Small things hissed past. Paul screamed as field guns drum-rolled behind the German lines, painting an arc of fire across the horizon that threw the vast field of mud spikes into sharp relief. Another shell struck. Muck flew. Something dragged a burning claw across his back, tearing shirt and skin. And Paul's scream climbed toward the thunder, and then stopped as his face dropped into the mud again. For a moment he was certain he was dying. His heart stuttered, beating so rapidly that it almost tripped over itself. He flexed his fingers, then moved his arm. It felt as though someone had opened him up and wiggled a knitting needle into his spine. But everything seemed to be working. He dragged himself forward half a yard, then froze as a shell crashed down behind him, blowing another great whirlpool of soil and body parts into the air. He could move. He was alive. He curled up in a puddle of water and clasped his hands to his head, trying to shut out the maddening roar of the guns, louder by far than the thunder had been. He lay as motionless as any of the corpses littering No Man's Land, his mind empty of all but terror, and waited for the bombardment to abate. The earth rocked. Red-hot shrapnel buzzed over his head. The 11-inch shells from the German guns kept coming down in mindless jackhammer repetition. He felt their heavy tread as they walked their way from one side of the British trenches to the other, leaving behind craters, splinters, and pulverized flesh. The excruciating noise would not stop. It was hopeless. The bombardment would never end. This was the crescendo, the finale, the moment when the war would finally set the skies themselves on fire, and the clouds would fall sparkling and blazing from the heavens like burning curtains. Get out or die. There was no cover here, nowhere to hide. Paul turned onto his stomach once more and began to slither forward as the earth bucked beneath him. Get out or die. Ahead, the ground sloped away to a lowland where once, years ago, before the shells had begun falling, a stream might have run. At the bottom lay a tongue of mist. Paul saw only a place to hide, a white murkiness that he could draw over him like a blanket. Hidden, he would sleep.